Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and I've got with me today Matt Matum.
Hello.
And Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. And this episode, we'll be talking to Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe about their bonkers two-hander horror, The Lighthouse. We'll be chatting to Tom Hanks about glove puppets for A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood, and we'll be discussing, in whispers, A Quiet Place Part 2. So let's crack on. It's time to work remotely.
What made your last keeper leave?
He believed that there was some enchantment in the light. Went mad, he did. Tall tales.
So that's The Lighthouse, starring Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. Matt, tell us what they get up to in this film.
Well, on one level, it's actually quite a simple film because it's really basic what actually happens. It's these two lighthouse keepers. Willem Dafoe plays Thomas, who's the elder lighthouse keeper, and he's the kind of experienced one, and he's got a new apprentice in the form of Ephraim, played by Robert Pattinson. And it's basically just these two in a lighthouse for 90 odd minutes, but they slowly succumb to madness, basically. There's different ways you can read it, but that's the kind of gist, like the isolation and being stuck with just each other in this really confined space for that amount of time basically starts to send them and us a bit nuts. And there's some fantastical elements mixed in. You never quite know how to interpret it. It's all a bit ambiguous. And it's also filmed in kind of black and white, reduced ratio. So it's extremely atmospheric in that way. It's not like a normal film you'd see at the cinema, and has this really overwhelming sound design as well. So it's very much an overwhelming sort of sensory experience.
So I talked to both Pattinson and Dafoe for the current issue of Total Film, which is available to buy now in shops, just in case you didn't know that. Before we talk about the film and decide whether that reduced ratio, etc. worked, let's have a listen to what they had to say when our Hollywood reporter, Adam Tanswell, sat down with them recently. First of all, Dafoe told us why this film is so intriguing.
It is pretty experimental. It's cinema. It's not television. It's very cinematic. The language of how we're shooting. Also, the language, the script, the text is very poetic. It's unusual. This movie is very particular. It's also shot in black and white. It's a two-hander. It bends time. It bends, sense of character. It's a very unique film, I think.
As we heard in the trailer, Dafoe talks in a very distinctive accent, doesn't he? And we've enjoyed shouting some of the things he says in the film across the office. I like to say, "Yeah, friend of me lobster." I did an impression for Willem to his face.
Did he appreciate it?
Not especially, but I thought it was very good. So Adam asked him how he found that ooh-ah accent.
It's written in a dialect as far as the rhythm and how the images are made. So really when you approach it, you know you're going to want to do an accent because it requires it. I mean, just the way it's written, I can't do it in my regular accent. So we played around with various accents, and then we really fell upon the one that it really felt that the only way to do it was this kind of West Country, English, Dorset, kind of pirate accent. And that was, once I found that, then you got to place it in your voice the same, the right place, and then you try to find the rhythms and try to find the images. And then once you find that, you have to root it and use it in the scene as if it's normal language, because this is not a show. This guy that I play is a storyteller, but it's not a show. This is the way he talks. So you have to take all that practice and all that study and all that poetry and make it normal, which is a challenge.
And he also asked how much fun it was ordering Robert Pattinson around.
I just loved the text so much. Some of the expressions the character used, some of the language, some of the slang is very beautiful. It's very evocative. And it was fun to use those words to play with him. Because particularly in the beginning of the story, without giving away too many spoilers, I sort of put him through his paces. So I enjoyed testing him and torturing him a little bit. And I had the language to do it.
There's a lot of dark humour in the film, so we also asked Dafoe if there was a lot of laughter on set as well.
Not really, because the conditions. I mean, we were all happy because it was a good project, and I liked everybody. Good opportunities for everyone to do the things they love to do in their jobs. And a small company. And because the weather was so harsh, there's a camaraderie because you're all so miserable, but find your ways to be happy. So there's a camaraderie in the misery. So a lot of laughing, no, but a sense of purpose and a pleasure and fun, yes, but a kind of grim fun.
So that was Willem Dafoe and Pattinson stuck in a small village in Nova Scotia with terrible weather. So we asked Robert Pattinson, did he find it a demanding shoot?
I guess pretty demanding, but I mean in a very strangely pleasurable way. Like, I think whenever you do a part where you don't really have to act too much, it's just everything is just put, the elements are pushed into your face. You're constantly reactive to things. There's your reaction to the weather, you're reacting to kind of just everything in the environment. And also the production design was so incredible. You basically felt you were, I mean, if the camera wasn't there, you'd be basically experiencing what the character's experiencing in the story. So it's kind of great.
Pattinson in particular spends most of the movie soaking wet and filthy. How was that?
Once you get used to it, it's sort of lovely. And also there's something about the costumes. The costumes are so well made and they're almost identical to what they would have been wearing in the time. I never really would have thought of it. A wool suit is more effective to keep warm than any kind of winterized modern clothing. I spent a whole night in the ocean, in the middle of the night in Nova Scotia, and wool has this strange property where it still retains its warmth even when it's completely soaking wet. And I had no idea it had those properties, but it's kind of nice.
Obviously, Pattinson was once a sparkly vampire in Twilight and has since parlayed that into an art house career. So did he think it was important to make that change in his career?
In my head, I've just been art house the whole way through. I've tried to make everything I do as art house as possible. I mean, I was very, very lucky to work with people who are really good, but also to work with people who are really fun. I mean, I've had like one bad experience on a movie, and I've been doing it now for 15, 16 years. Mm. And even the bad experience wasn't that bad. It really helps. I mean, if you're not bitter, you're not jaded about anything, you can stay really positive about every single job and you're excited about the next one. And also, I have just as much enthusiasm for film, if not more, than I did when I first started.
And as he's about to play Batman, we also asked how The Lighthouse prepared him for playing Bruce Wayne.
Every job sort of kind of feeds into the next one in one way or another. I feel like there's elements of good time and high life in this, and then even there's elements of The King, and then I did this other movie called The Devil All the Time, and I think it's the really good thing about doing parts that are really, really different from each other, because you figure out different ways, lots of different ways to do things, which can contribute to the next project you do.
So that's the boys of The Lighthouse chatting about their very difficult shoot up in Nova Scotia. Do you see that struggle on screen? Does it come through? Does the madness and the sort of darkness and the dampness come through on screen for you guys?
I think so.
I
felt like I had cabin fever by the end of this. It's the sort of film that grabs you by the shoulders and shakes you until the very end. It's an experience.
Definitely. It really is an experience. Let's talk about the weird things that happen. I mean, without giving away any spoilers, there's sort of a lot of farting, there's wanking, there's mermaids. I mean, it's not a traditional black and white sort of Victorian setup, is it?
No. I mean, Matt mentioned the fantastical elements earlier, and they are interweaved into this quite serious tale of madness in a very strange and surreal way that gives the whole picture this very odd feeling. Robert Eggers, who did The Witch, which is also this supernatural story, but also feels grounded in a period piece. And it's quite similar feel here. I'd say it's not a horror. A lot of people have been calling it a horror film, but it doesn't feel like that. It's more psychological weirdness.
Kind of psychedelic even.
Yeah.
And it's also kind of a comedy as well at the same time. Like, it's actually really funny. Like, you mentioned the dialogue, and you will come out of this just doing impressions of them afterwards.
Yes.
And repeating choice lines of dialogue, but it's actually really funny, and that also kind of adds to the whole weirdness of it, I think, as well. It's like weird, dark humour.
Yeah, it's very discombobulating because you can't really tell what is real and what isn't, and people could come out of this and have two different opinions on what it actually was about, what was actually happening. You know, is this, you know, a whole treatise on guilt of one character? Is it literally about two guys going mental, drinking the lighter fluid that they're supposed to be feeding the lamp? is it actually sort of folklore tale? It's there's all sorts of things going on that you could take from it. And I think that's what's quite exciting about it, that you can take whatever you like from it.
Yeah, they introduced the lamp itself at the top of the lighthouse quite early on as this mystical presence kind of haunting them. And it does add this level of like a question in there that you're wondering what exactly is going on. And it never plays its hand to give you a definitive answer. So when you come out, you're still questioning it. I think it's a film people will be talking about for a very long time. I mean, we all saw it quite a while ago because it did the festival circuit as well.
It opened in Cannes and to sort of rave reviews there, and then it went around and onto TIFF. And audiences have loved it. And that's what's sort of been interesting about it as well. When I talked to Willem Dafoe, he said that, you know, he loves the fact that people go into this film not knowing what to expect, and that no matter what they think of it, whether they like it or hate it, they've enjoyed the ride of it and the experience, that it is unlike anything they've seen before, and they really couldn't predict what was going to happen. And in this day and age of sort of quite, you know, sort of homogenous films and franchises and things that you feel you've seen before, it's quite exciting to see something that you really don't know where it's going.
Yeah, definitely. I think the black and white and the ratio of the film really adds to the whole mystical element, and it makes you think you're seeing something that's both really old, feels like old cinema, but also very, very new, and using new techniques and using all these the aspects that it can do today. And you've got these two central performances that are just so amazing. I'd love Robert Pattinson in it.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, you're not thinking about Edward Cullen when you're watching this film, are you?
I mean, it's a bit unfair for both of them that they've been completely ignored in the award season.
Yeah.
I think especially Willem, you'd think they might have shown him a bit of love.
I think in any other year, if it wasn't such a strong year, they would have both been nominated. But obviously they've been sort of locked out by other performances this year, along with Adam Sandler. Well, that is The Lighthouse, which I think we can all agree is bonkers, but brilliant.
Yeah, it's highly recommended, but I'd say go prepared. Like, if you just think you fancy a bit of a maritime drama, like, this isn't that film. It's truly, truly weird. So be
yeah,
prepared.
If your dad's really into exactly. lighthouses, it's not going to be for him. That's out on the 31st of January. So let's move on from mental and physical cruelty to the personification of kindness in Mr. Rogers.
Hello, neighbor.
Mr. Rogers,
I'm here to interview you.
It is so nice to meet you.
You okay?
Profiling Mr. Rogers.
Lloyd, please don't ruin my childhood.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
So that's Hollywood's nicest man, Tom Hanks, starring as the world's nicest TV presenter, Mr. Rogers, in A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood. Jack, for those of us who don't know who Mr. Rogers was, tell us how he fits into this narrative.
So Mr. Rogers was an American TV presenter who did a show called Mr. Rogers Neighborhood, in which he spoke with puppets and kind of introduced these fantastical characters who all taught children nice lessons on how to live good lives and made them feel special and sung them a little song. But within this film, there's a journalist who's out to try and get a story on him. He's normally a war correspondent who does all these big profiles, and he's given Mr. Rogers to write a piece on, and he's not very happy about that, and is kind of looking for almost something salacious in the Mr. Rogers story, but then is won over by the kindness of this children's TV presenter.
So we'll get on to whether this film made us weep buckets, but first, Adam Tanswell sat down with Hanks at TIFF to find out what the process was for him in playing a real life person.
Actually, a specific question that I had with Mari. The boss, were we going to do a photo realistic version of him? Were we going to use dental? Were we going to change my teeth? There was a very specific sort of nose. Were we going to do something with a CGI? And she said, no, you'll have a wig and we'll do something with the eyebrows and that's it. I said, okay, so that's one confine of it. Then the shared concern we had that Mr. Rogers is a funny, talking, sounding, looking guy that has become something of a, you know, comedic meme for, you know, cultural kind of like signpost of something that is odd and amusing. So taking that, which is part of a TV persona for some, but is actually the person of Fred Rogers, that became the big challenge of everything that we did, outside of the choice of the, you know, the cardigan sweaters and the and what have you, had to be some other version of a recognizable, as opposed to a stereotypical or characters, or actually an impression of somebody, as opposed to an embodiment of somebody. That sounds more highfalutin than I think I deserve to be able to say, because there's an awful lot of physical cadences, there's the way he talked, there are pronunciations. Getting to that is a bit of contrary to an awful lot of what I understand movie making needs to be, which is fast and energetic and competitive and wild, and he was not any of that.
Mr. Rogers used a lot of hand puppets in his show, as you said, Jack. So did he have to do some puppet training?
I went home with a training puppet. I went home with a Daniel Striped Tiger that had no stripes, but he had everything else, and I worked with him in a mirror. I did a thing where I could not see myself in the mirror, but I could see him, and worked on, you know, some of the specifics of the motion.
And what insight did Hanks get into Mr. Rogers' worldview just from playing him?
It was a matter of listening, because when you look at the show, he is talking to one specific person just a couple of inches on the other side of the screen. So you'll notice that when he says things like you, often you find that, or we, he never said, hey, kids, you know, it was always very specific. That, along with the moments of listening, even when he's with other people, like when he was visiting, you know, a band or a store, or, you know, going to the pasta factory to see how spaghetti is made, he would include that one person along with him. And along with the silence and along with that look comes the whole philosophy of what he was doing. He was not using an audience in order to sell something or to communicate something. He was actually inviting his little audience member along with it. Like when he would hear music, he would literally say, wasn't that just beautiful, you know, and then come back and talk to people. So some people would view that as breaking a fourth wall or, you know, reading the news or whatever. But no, it was actually part of the filmmaking manifestation of what his whole philosophy of is why he was there in the first place.
So, Matt, did this warm the cockles of your heart? Did you feel the kindness of Mr. Rogers coming out of the screen?
I really did. There's something just so soothing about Tom Hanks anytime, like in that interview, just being blasted with his kind of foghorn voice. It's just a nice feeling. And this role really suits him. It's kind of Mr. Rogers himself was a bit of an odd character. Like especially if you didn't grow up with him, as a lot of us British people didn't, he can seem a bit unusual. But yeah, you just warm to him instantly when it's Tom Hanks. And it's one of those films where I genuinely came out thinking, I want to be a nicer person. And
yeah,
is the closest I've ever felt, really, especially recently, that a film's come to feeling like a therapy session.
Yes.
Where you genuinely come out feeling a bit like, whoa, I've got some thoughts off my chest in there and I feel a bit different, you know.
Did you like it, Jack?
Yeah, I really, really liked it. It did feel like a therapy session in some ways, because Tom Hanks, Mr. Rogers, approaches people and would always manage to diffuse the situation. Especially we see the journalist in this film asking quite tough questions, and then Mr. Rogers kind of turns it around and you believe it because Tom Hanks is just so good, and it's Tom Hanks, you know. Mm-hmm. It's hard to differentiate between the two because everyone knows that Tom Hanks is notoriously nice, and then he's playing a character who's also notoriously nice. It's like a match made in heaven, and so you believe that's probably how Tom Hanks would hopefully talk.
And it's also that interesting thing that why is our default sort of setting to question why somebody would be so nice, when in fact the film sort of asks the question, what if we just accepted that kindness and niceness are things that are in the world and we should celebrate them rather than trying to sort of tear them down? Which it feels like this film is very much a film we need for the current times we're living in, with the news and everything that we're seeing, that this sort of is a sort of warm hug in the cinema for people that might be feeling overwhelmed by the news reports.
Yeah, definitely. I think Mary O'Heller does a really excellent job of directing it as well, because she plays with the format of Rogers' show within the film itself. Like when they change scenes, it kind of comes out. It's actually a diorama of the city they're in, and you kind of see these model cars being pushed around and stuff. And it's nice and fun and kind of keeps it quite strange at the same time, but it works really well. I thought the film was quite pacey as well.
She also does a really good job for if, like us British people, you have never had any experience of Mr. Rogers and his TV show, of immediately bringing you up to speed of what it was like and what to expect from it. And yeah, like you say, the way it blends those formats helps with that as well, because it sort of introduces this journalist character played by Matthew Rhys. He almost becomes like a character in the show in that sense. So yeah, it's really, really well done.
He's us, isn't he? He's sort of going into this world going, why does this man with jumpers and hand puppets and who talks in this very sing-song cadence and it's sort of very soothing, why does he even exist? And he's sort of the person that leads us into that world. But if you were a cynical, mean person, would this film just really irritate you and just be awful? Would this be the thing that would be terrible for you to have to go and see at the cinema?
I hope not, because it does start from that place of cynicism, because like you said, we are following this character Lloyd through the film, and he comes from a very cynical place, and he comes from this opinion that kind of, who is this guy, what's he doing, he's like a relic, and isn't particularly interested in him, and he's not really won over very easily, and he's dealing with a lot of his own problems as well at home, which is adding to it. So yeah, the film I don't think necessarily hopes that you're going to love Mr. Rogers from the very beginning. So I hope that cynics will get something.
But I mean,
you could
find it incredibly irritating. I mean, there are a lot of scenes that are incredibly cute, and it does require a certain suspension of cynicism, I would say, if you want to enjoy it.
You could say that, but I don't know. It's hard because I was really won over by it.
We're all such cynics anyway, and we all liked it. So come on, like.
Yeah, I think everyone I watched it with seemed to really love it and was won over by it. The only weakness in the film for me was Lloyd, the journalist's arc. There was some parts of it where I was like, he isn't as interesting as a character as Mr. Rogers, and you almost want to just see Tom Hanks on screen more and kind of go more into his story, because he is the supporting character. He's not the leading man in this. And so perhaps sometimes I was slightly let down that we didn't see more of him on screen and kind of go perhaps more into his background. You know, they briefly mention Mr. Rogers' own children in a scene that's quite revealing, and you feel like you're only slightly taking away some of the layers behind Mr. Rogers, and it's more about the journalist and how his life has changed.
But also from a writer's perspective, which we all are, obviously, it's very frustrating to see this guy get so much interview time with someone that he's only supposed to be doing a small piece on.
I know.
And he spends months doing it, and then he ends up filing like 10,000. And it's like, come on, man. Like,
we've made it the cover, actually.
I know.
That would never happen. Yeah,
that was when the cynics in us really kind of came to the fore.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice to spend that much time with one of the actors that we get to interview instead of the 20 minutes we get in a hotel suite before we're booted out of the door? So there you go. We've ended that on a cynicism as we started. So Beautiful Day is out on the 31st as well, so you can take your choice between Warm and Cozy or Wet and Wild. Okay, let's look ahead to a future release. Shh, everybody, let's get quiet for this.
There's nothing left. Please. There are people out there worth saving.
You don't know, do you? I do. The people that are left, they're not the kind of people worth saving.
Okay, that's A Quiet Place Part 2. The trailer dropped on New Year's Day, and it's the current cover of our new horror issue, which is in shops right now, in case I didn't mention it.
And Jane, you are the person to talk about this film, really, because you were on set of A Quiet Place Part 2, weren't you?
Yeah, in the summer I went up to upstate New York and was on set when they filmed with Cillian Murphy and Emily Blunt and the two children who were returning. And I did spend a lot of time talking to John Krasinski, the writer-director, who was also in the first one and unfortunately didn't make it to the end of that film. So, but from the trailer, we are going to see the first day of the alien attack. So do we think that Krasinski's going to be actually back from the dead in the second film?
99.999% that he will definitely be back in this film.
And I know, Matt, you'll be concerned, will his jumper be back?
I love his jumper. Yeah.
Oh, he does have a good jumper, doesn't he?
He has a great jumper.
Yeah, he was dad goals for me in that film. So I'm really very much hoping he'll get some sort of pivotal cameo because, yeah, as you mentioned, in the trailer, we do see day one of the alien invasion, and that kind of opens up so many possibilities for this film. And it's just such a, in the trailer, that's such a great scene, that day one where you just see all this panic that's occurring in their little town before the events that will lead to where we started.
And Cillian Murphy playing this guy, Emmett, who's another survivor that they come across, who tells them that some of the people that are left are not worth saving. That puts a whole other spin on the horror, the human horror that's out there in this horrible apocalypse. It's not just the aliens that are horrendous, it's the humans, which opens it up to all sorts of possibilities, which I can't wait to see. And also, I'm really concerned about that baby, because frankly, how are they going to keep that baby quiet?
It's interesting that the human element, I feel like it's been played around a lot in zombie films, where you kind of have, there's the zombie threat, but then also the human threat's almost worse because you know someone's going to turn on you. And I guess with Cillian Murphy's character, at the moment, it's really unclear whether he's going to be a villain or a hero in the piece. You get evil vibes from him that he's going to turn and not be that helpful in the end, but we just don't know at the moment.
It's a really good trailer and it's made me very excited for the film, yeah. Even more so than having been on set with it.
It's part two. Obviously the biggest film that is kind of part two is Godfather Part Two. And I keep thinking that in Godfather Part Two, they kind of go back into Marlon Brando's life and kind of back in time. And in this one, it feels like they're going back in time again. It seems like John Krasinski's gone, what part two can I use as a frame? Yeah.
I think he'd be very pleased with that if you likened it to the Godfather trilogy. And does that mean then we're probably going to get a trilogy?
What a disappointing third part.
Hopefully not.
Maybe. Okay. Well, if you want to read more about that set visit, do get our current issue. That's it for this episode. There's just time for another question from a reader. Fiona Craven wants to know, what's your best souvenir from a film set?
I don't know if you're ever allowed to take anything. You have to sign so many embargoes whenever you've gone into these visits that I'm trying to think if I've ever actually taken a souvenir. Maybe like a call sheet's probably the best thing you get to take away, especially if it's got your name in it. That's always just a very exciting souvenir.
When you've got like number one, you've got the major star, and then right at the bottom, you've got also on set, Jane Crow, the total film. That's still really cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
And obviously you do take away a lunch. Let's not forget that you take away the food from the day, which is always very delicious.
And the memories.
I once nearly got away with a Skyfall pass that I was given and it was tucked in my coat. And when I left, I didn't remember that. Got in the car park, realised it was there, thought, oh my God, I've got an amazing souvenir, until I was apprehended by security and had it taken off me. So that was my near souvenir, but I don't actually have anything proper. Do you, Jack?
No. No, I don't have anything. I haven't been on that many set visits because online stuff.
No friends, no famous friends and no souvenirs.
Well, no. I'd like to think that after my Men in Black set visit, me and Tessa Thompson are now friends. I can only dream. But no, they don't let you take anything. You kind of walk past everyone and you just go like, oh, wow, there are so many aliens and weird people here. But then you're being kind of looked after by a press person, aren't you, when you go around? So there's not really much chance. And they're also like fidgety and funny. I'd say the funniest thing about set visits is probably just watching the extras and what they're doing while everything else is going on. Because everyone's just kind of like twiddling their thumbs while this film's being made.
On their phones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
A tiny non-souvenir I took from Avengers Infinity War, because security was so tight on that set. You even had to have a little sticker put over your phone camera, just even though you weren't allowed your phone out, but just to make double sure you weren't going to be snapping any sort of secret pictures. So I came in with a tiny little shield sticker on my phone. Obviously, I had to take it off eventually, but kept it on there till it was faded and dirty. So that was quite nice.
Okay, so we will try harder, Fiona, to steal more things in future.
That is a promise.
Yeah, that's a promise. Okay, and as always, don't forget, there is 10% off Total Film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF at checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. So that's it from us. Please join us next time, and we'll just say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.